Is our main speaker for the evening, Paul G. from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. My name is Paul G., and I'm a recovering, grateful alcoholic tonight. And I'm happy everybody showed up. There's a couple people that are not here tonight. I'm not going to name their names, but I was kind of looking forward to seeing them. How many Al-Anons do we have in the room? If you don't mind, just stick it. Yeah, okay. All right, I see. All right, good. My sobriety date is October 24th, 1988. I got sober in the sobriety capital of the world, Riverside, California. My home group then was the Casablanca Speakers Meeting, which has been around for, I don't know, long before I came into the program. And we would have people like Clancy and Cliff Roach. I shouldn't have said his name. Cliff R. People from the Pacific group. And we had rules in our meeting. We had a steering committee. Speakers didn't come up the podium without a coat and a tie, or you didn't talk. What else? We had greeters. We had cup washer. We had butt people. We had ashtray people. We had moppers. We had girls and guys bathroom people. We had parking lot people. There was a lot of little jobs that you could volunteer for to be a service. And I remember going to the meeting, and I sat way in the back. The guy's waving at me back there. And we had a little canopy off the side of this auditorium in the Lutheran church there, Trinity Lutheran. And it was where we call it the half measures area. And it was a little area where you were kind of tucked in. And I enjoyed that area because I could watch all you people while the speaker was talking. And that's my other disease. I came in through the back door of Al-Anon before I got sober. And I have the disease of watching. If you don't know what that is. I was reminded on the way over here tonight that I should practice the serenity prayer by someone that isn't even in the program. Yeah. You know, courage to change the things I can and the wisdom to know the difference. You know, I was worrying about my 10-minute speaker getting here on time. And she says, well, you can't change that. So I've been blessed. I've been blessed with this little voice in my ear. And it holds me accountable today. My sponsor is a woman, a little controversial in Alcoholics Anonymous. However, when there was a guy that came from the Pacific group, he sponsored quite a few women in the program. In fact, it was 3/4 of the synagogue on Wednesday night. All the rows, if you went to that meeting, you would have to get there at 4:30 and stand in line in Brentwood outside the church while all the sponsees marked the chairs. And then you had to sit in the folding section way out in the back at the synagogue. And that was the way it worked. And so I thought if he could sponsor people that were women, then I could have a woman sponsor. My first sponsor was Water Truck Frank. He got sober at the Pomona Triangle Group, if you know where that is, up next to the fairgrounds in Los Angeles. He was a water truck driver. And I liked him because he was rebellious. He used to sit in the meeting I went to on Wednesday night with a kazoo. And he'd pull it out of his top pocket and play Happy Birthday when they did the birthdays. But he never tried it in that meeting with the steering committee, because they would have kicked him out. But I liked him because he was rebellious, and that's how I felt I was. I didn't want to follow any rules. And like Musa said tonight, there was that little part that I never read in the book, you know. And I wanted to show up when I wanted to at the meetings. And, you know, I wasn't washing any cups or any of that kind of stuff. In fact, the first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I came with a friend of mine, Pat, from the Friday night Al-Anon meeting at Community Hospital. And she said, why don't we go over there and see what those alcoholics do? She says, after our meeting here, I usually go over to the Casablanca meeting, and it gives me an idea how I can figure out my husband. She says, why don't you come and see what's on? It's very interesting. She says, you can sit with me, and we'll just sit, you know, toward the back. And I went in that night with Pat after the Al-Anon meeting, and I heard my story. And, you know, it wasn't my idea to become an alcoholic. That was not at the top of my list. To come up to a meeting and look out in the crowd and say, you know, I have this. It's mine. I own it. And this is why. You know, I grew up in a family in Chula Vista, if you know where that is. They call it something else now. And my father and mother never drank. Not a drop. There was no booze in the house except for Gallo Sherry, which was under the sink, and she used it to pour all over the roast every Sunday. And we'd take a little ride to the Presbyterian Church that was over in South Park. The church still stands there today on 30th. And we had our little allowance that we would, she would give us money to put in the envelopes to put in the basket. And my brother and I would run away from church and go to the liquor store, buy candy. And we'd come back. And we had to learn things like John 3:16 and all these different passages in that particular church. And we wore these little clip-on ties in 1960. And we were just like a leave-it-to-beaver family. Okay. And my mother wore a little apron, and she served everyone when they sat at the table. And all you had to do is say, I want another glass of milk, and she'd get up and go pour it for you. And she was the ultimate enabler. She was the person that had no self, because she was the martyr that did for you what you should be doing for yourself. And she did things like robbed me of the dignity to make a mistake in my life so that I would find out for myself. I learned these wonderful behaviors. And then I began to practice them before I came in to these rooms. And I was 31 when I came into Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had been married for a short time, and God bless her, she got the hell away from me. I was like a prison guard. And, I didn't realize that till I came into these rooms. You know, I just thought that maybe the problem was we need to have more sex. Anybody relate to that? Any of the guys? You know, she used to tell me I didn't listen. Things like, you don't listen. You don't hear me. You know? And I just told you that. Didn't you hear that, what I just said? And she used to say things like, what you said the other night when we were over at such and such a barbecue humiliated me. God, I couldn't believe you did that or said that in front of them. And you know, those were the days of my blackout drinking. Anybody relates to the blackouts? I see heads going up and down. You know, it's like chemical-induced amnesia. I can't remember. I don't have a clue. You could tell me word for word what I did or how I behaved and what I said. And I'd say, nah, wasn't me. It must have been somebody else. I didn't do that. But I always woke up on the cold tile floor wrapped around my American Standard about 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, and I remember being at a guy's house down the street. And I lost my keys. And Sunday morning, I couldn't find my keys to go for a drive. And I was told, well, go back down to the house where the barbecue was. You drunk? You probably left them down there. I went down there, and my friend couldn't find them. And that afternoon, he called me. He was cleaning his barbecue out. And the men always stood around the backyard, and we built big bonfires in the Weber, you know. The women sat inside and drank wine. And they talked about us, you know. How bad we were, and he says, I found your keys at the bottom of the Weber, and they were all melted together, you know, all the plastic parts, and he gave me my keys, and these are the kind of things I did, you know. I lost my car at the El Cortez Hotel. You know, how do you lose your car? You know, I ended up in places like Florida or something, when I just went out to go to a surfer dance, and 3-4 days later I wake up in Palm Beach, some motel, with a bunch of people I don't even know. And here comes the best part. If I went over to your house and party, and we were having a good time, everybody was feeling pretty good, I used to pinch a little bit. I was the kind of person that, I drove around and I would find things before they officially got lost.
How was you?
Just little things like, construction tractors and, wheelbarrows and pallets of used brick. Maybe, I don't know, some electrical supplies. That was in the days before they put everything in them lockup containers. They just let it out on the job site. And, boy, we had fun. And that was during the building boom out in Riverside in the early 80s. That's when they built that whole town out there. And a couple of six-packs, some Miller High Life, and, maybe a little weed, and it's on. Let's go. And that was kind of the way I lived, I came from San Diego. I moved out of San Diego when I was 21 years old. I worked for the restaurant business. And I managed to get from a cook to an assistant manager to a manager of a restaurant. And, boy, what a great job. Especially the restaurants that had cocktail lounges, Because I got to hire the bartenders. And I got to do the inventory. And I remember waking up in the morning, oftentimes on Sunday morning, and I'd spent the whole night at the restaurant. Slept in one of the booths in the bar. Just locked up the restaurant. I told the dishwasher to lock it up. I'd take care of it in the morning. And I always had an extra white shirt and a black tie and a pair of black pants in the office in case I had to do a quick shower and go to work the next day. And so I kind of got stuck in that rut, working in the restaurant. But it really helped me out because there was an abundant supply of what I needed. And it just seemed like one continuous party. I came to this program and what I realized was that I drank because I wanted to change the way I felt. That was the only reason. I didn't know how I felt because I had been drinking for so long. It started with Tester's glue. Tester's glue. And then kind of went to the next thing. Don't ever try to smoke catnip. Or banana peels. And they found one of my buddies down in the Chula Vista Municipal Golf Course one night with his boxer shorts on, running crazy. The sheriff picked him up because him and some of my other buddies found this root from some kind of a plant that grew by the ponds, and they boiled it up and made a tea out of it. And they drank it. I wasn't with them that night. And they found my buddy and arrested him and put him in the nut house for the weekend. These are the kind of things we did. It was just insanity. I had parents that just sat back and thought, if this kid would just get Jesus, if he would just, what is wrong? Okay. I had an older sister that went away to Woodstock, crawled out the window and left. And I remember as just a small kid going to the hospital with my parents, and they would pump her stomach out, and she had some near-death experiences. And so the ism was there, and it was acting out among my siblings. And at that time, I don't think I was really aware of what it was all about. I don't recall a lot of pain in my family. I don't really recall that, growing up. Other than my father and my mother, there was a lot of double messages. There was messages like, I remember driving through Logan Heights. Now, in 1962, Logan Heights was solid black. White folks did not hang out, nor did they drive through that area. If you did, it was, and we drove that way to church every Sunday. And my dad used to say, roll up the windows, because we're going through Antown. And then he'd make comments on the way to church. Look at them sitting on their front porches, sitting up on those old sofas. None of them are working. They're all on welfare. And he'd dog them all out, and then he'd do the Sunday school class. Okay? Those kind of messages. So, I don't think my dad was feeling too good about himself. You know? I mean, after I did my inventory of this program, when I got to this program, I did a little bit of therapy. I remember sitting with the therapist one day, and we were doing one-on-one, and he says, you know, you got to decontaminate. I said, what? He says, man, he says, you hate everybody. Now, you even hate your own. You even hate your own. What the hell is wrong with you? He says, you know what? He says, you're not coming back to my office until you go out there and you make a friend. And he's going to be the biggest, blackest dude that you have ever seen in your life. Just don't come back to my office until you make a friend that's black. And don't try to make it up. So I went to my Thursday night meeting, and there was this big dude with a Jerry curl. You know, it's that drippy shit. I don't think they have it anymore. It's that shit they used to put on their hair, you know, dripping all over on the. It's all over their clothes. And he was 6 foot something. He just looked big to me. He was a big guy, and he was dark. Okay. And I worked up the courage to meet him. He was a newcomer. He was at Whiteside Manor. And I thought, man, I'm going to go ask that guy because I want to go back and see his therapist. You know, I got to get to the bottom of all this stuff. I went up and I asked him, and he said, my name's Keith. He said, yo. What? Yo, I'm Keith. And so, you know, I got his phone number, and I went back, and I showed my therapist. He goes, okay. He says, now we have a next step. And this is kind of how it went, you know. And I ended up making friends, and the next thing I know, I was going to Central America. I learned how to speak Spanish fluent, and I did some mission work in Guatemala, and I lived with Indians up in the mountains, like Mayan people, you know, barefoot and stuff, you know, carrying babies on their back. And I don't know how you get from where I was to there. I just don't know that. That hate. But what I learned was nothing but fear. It was the fear of the unknown. Yeah, fear of the unknown. And that fear, whatever I said or whatever my dad did, would keep a buffer in between him and them. And that's how they lived their life. So there was a lot of fear in my family. It wasn't the kind of fear that I hear in these meetings, you know, people saying, my dad beat the shit out of my mom and threw her up against the wall and blood was everywhere. And the violence was horrible. It wasn't that. It was kind of a more subtle kind of a disease. You know, when I raise my hand in Al-Anon, I say, you know what? I realize in my program that this disease has nothing to do with alcohol. Nothing. People look at me weird, especially the new people. What? This is alcohol. This is... We're reading the 12 steps of alcohol. It has nothing to do with alcohol. The big book says it's a spiritual deficiency. You know? And it says that, you know, there's emotional things that connect to that. Social problems. And how I relate to other people. How I have relationships. You know? I learned that to enable or to help somebody or do for somebody what they could do for themselves is not love. I used to hear people say, but I love him. Just give him a little money and help him out. God damn, I don't know why he did that with the money. I don't know why he went out and bought those drugs. I don't know why he did this, do that. But, you know, to that attachment to that money gave that person power. And I came here looking for a higher power. So it's kind of baffling how the disease, for me today, how the understanding of what the disease is. I had a friend when I first came into this program, he said, when you get sober and you start going to meetings, you're going to notice things differently. I thought, what the hell does that mean, right? And then I went home and I tried to get everybody to get into the program. I bet there's nobody in here that went to the literature table and, like, knew somebody they were going to give some literature to, you know? And my sponsor said, who made you the ambulance driver? Take off your God badge. You know? Stuff like that. And her name is the original Madonna up in Riverside. And I talk to her from time to time. She's my spiritual, my little spiritual voice at the back of my head. It says, well, you'll know what to do. Just call me when you find the answer. So hang up. You know? And I remember going to the meetings and walking out of the meetings and thinking, well, how come nobody's giving me any advice? You know, I never understood what that plaque when I went into the Alano clubs said. I am responsible. I am responsible. Well, responsible to what? You know, and I go to meetings and I hear people share in the we. Well, you know, we here at Alcoholics Anonymous, we do this and we do that. I felt like saying, well, what the hell? You're not my spokesperson. How do you know what I do in my program? That's what's so beautiful about this program, is that I can have my own higher power today. When I got here with that higher power from that church in South Park that my dad taught and all that, my sponsor says, I want you to write down about all that higher power. And I wrote it all down. And she looked at it. She started to tear up a piece of paper. I said, wait, what are you doing? It took me a lot of time to do that. She goes, well, now you can have your own higher power. You can pick out your own higher power. It doesn't have to be that one. You know? And, wow, what a relief that was. You know? And then I took a world religions class in community college. I couldn't believe some of the stuff that I was reading. I thought, wow, this is interesting stuff. I thought all those people were going to hell. You know? I thought that the religion I belonged to was the exclusive one. And so then I began to see that the ism was just transferred through the behaviors and through all the family itself. And I began to learn what they say in Al-Anon, that this is a family disease. We're not bad people because we have the disease. But, you know, and then I had this other sponsor. His name was Richie. He was a car thief in New York City. And I liked him. He used to tell me that his sponsor, Keith, said to keep a Webster's Dictionary handy next to your big book, because you're going to need it. Because guys like you think you know it all. And I remember looking up the word disease. An uncurable sickness. There's no cure. And then I remember seeing people die in my life that I loved from cancer, heart disease, brain tumors, strokes, diseases that have no cure. I don't think they're bad people. So I just couldn't, you know. I was always told that the drinkers and the druggers and all, they were the scumbags. My dad used to take us down there just to look at them, down there on down by Horace Plaza. Horton Plaza. Yeah. Well, I think there was whores there, too. I don't know. Anyway, he used to take us down there, and he'd take us down there to that mission that was right there next to the Bohemian Bread Factory in San Diego. I remember what it was. That was the ghetto. That was the Skid Row in San Diego. And there were people sleeping on the streets and begging, and they were having bonfires in those 50-gallon drums. And my dad said, but I'm coming down here to help these folks. You know? And I thought, well, I didn't know anything about it. So I knew that in order to be an alcoholic, you had to be one of them. One of those. And then out in Riverside, I met a guy by the name of Wild Willie. And he lived on the street 15 years, and he was stone cold sober. He lived out of a grocery basket. And this guy had an intelligence higher than most people. And he stored his clothes in all the trees in Riverside, in those little plastic grocery bags. He'd have underwear, clean socks, a nice change of a shirt. And the way that he kept it away from all the other homeless people is he climbed up in trees at nighttime and tied his stuff up. And if he needed something, he just went up. And I thought that was pretty intelligent. You know, it's about survival. I learned in this program that I can have anything I want here. The money I want? Yeah. I have the earning ability, it says in our book, maybe 10 times what somebody else has. 10 times the earning power. If I want to make $1 million, I can do that. I could go tonight with a piece of cardboard and sleep in the library. I think it's on E Street, F Street, downtown. I could give my little spot and lay there and be happy. Sober and alive today with good health. Doesn't matter whether I got 20 cents in my pocket or a $100 bill. It's not the source of my happiness today. Been there, done that. You know, people say, well, if I had $1 million, I would. They already know. To one guy, $50,000 is a lot of money. Another guy, only 10 might be a lot. You're down to Guatemala, and a guy said, well, all I need is 1,000. Everybody has their own idea. What I learned is that money is a tool. And that I've been blessed if I receive it, and I have to give it away. Concepts like giving it away. And then in Al-Anon, they said, you can't tell anybody when you do it, or it won't work. There's a little bookmark called Just for Today. Just for Today. I like to look at that. You know, giving it away. Just give it away. Would you go out there tonight, take your brand new Lexus and give it to somebody? I heard a preacher one time say, we ain't doing no car washes here. If you people really support this organization, you're going to go get the flat screen. And you're going to sell it. You're going to put the money up here. You're going to do something that's going to cost you. We ain't going to have no rummage sale. Don't bring your junk over here to sell. You know, that really hit me when I heard that one night in this particular place. I thought, you know, would I be willing to take off my gold and my jewelry and the things that mean the most to me and give them away? And trust that my higher power is going to give me if I need it back, or if my rent's going to be paid, or my mortgage is going to be paid, or car payments? Am I going to really think that the job is the source of my income today? My job? Is that really where the source is? Well, I learned in this program that the source of everything I have is my higher power. Friends, place to live, good health, love in my life. Didn't have no love in my life. Like Musa was saying, I came here and I went to Al-Anon for 9 months before I went to that first AA meeting with Pat. And after I was there 3 months, and I wasn't drinking. You know what it's like not to drink when you're an alcoholic and not have a program? We used to have a supermarket chain up there in Riverside called Stater Brothers, the hometown store. And I found things like Slurpees, Little Debbie's, you know? And those things took the place of the alcohol in the beginning. You know, and I heard old-timers saying when I first got here they used to give people Carol syrup and give them, mix it up in warm water and make them drink it to get rid of the shakes. And, you know, whatever my withdrawals were, after 3 months, this long-timer in Al-Anon says, you know, it's time, honey, that you lead the meeting on Friday night. So we wrote you down on the list to be the next leader of the meeting. And I knew that to be a leader, you had to tell your story. I thought, oh, jeez, man, how am I going to do that? By that time, I already knew that I was the enemy. And I was sitting in their room. And I thought, oh, man. You know? I heard women in Al-Anon say that they sat up on their husband's chest with a butcher knife when he was passed out in bed. He was going to slice his throat for the things that he did to them. I heard a speaker come one time and say that she caught her husband doing that at night, all sloppy drunk. In the middle of the night, she went out and got super glue and put it on his hand. Yeah, he had to go to the hospital when he woke up. You know, those women were serious. And so I had to go back there that Friday night and tell my story. And when I did, you know, I disclosed it. You know, I realized that I had a drinking problem. And that it wasn't all about her. And the reason I got there, it was her fault. It's her fault. What the hell? I don't have a problem. I just have a couple beers once in a while. It ain't my fault. She needs to be somewhere, not me. What the hell? I don't want to go to any Al-Anon meetings. Back then, it was all women. You know? They were the enemy. I got here because of her. You know? God, that pissed me off. And I remember sharing my story and going through that night. At the end of the night, everybody clapped. They just thought that was great. They come up to me and gave me hugs and everything. And they all went out to Coco's that night and had something. And one lady put her arm around me as we're going out. And I said, man, I was really sweating this being a leader tonight. She says, you know what, honey? We always knew you were an alcoholic. They just know. I heard them say things like, we just love to pick alcoholics and get married to them. We do that. You know, I have those tendencies today, you know, to want to help people a little too much. One of my problems was I like to give you my wonderful advice before you ask. Before you ask. That really pisses people off. Did you know that? They don't like that. Some people don't say anything, but generally it causes tension. And, you know, I'm about to get married in July. This is a real blessing. 12 more weeks, folks. I haven't been married for 20 years. And I made a commitment. And I'm going to keep my commitment. And I want to say that this program got me to there. I didn't live with my fiancée. Didn't move into her house. I went to counseling for several months. I learned how to say, honey, you're probably right. I learned how to say things like, I'm wrong. I made a mistake. I don't even know why she still hangs out with me, really, at this point. I mean, she could have picked somebody else. And, so I know that, you know, I'm about to embark on another whole part and a whole another adventure in my life today. Because when I first got here, I was unmarriable. I didn't look you in the eye. I wasn't able to make a commitment. I couldn't show up on time. And it was your fault. Your fault. You know, the newcomers get here and they say, you know what? If that asshole cop wouldn't have stopped me, I only had one beer. You know? And that judge, he's prejudiced. That's why he gave me 10 meetings and another 10 on top of that. It ain't my problem. I just had, you know, I like to party a little bit. And I learned this is the disease of blame. Because I didn't want to be what it said on that plaque. I am responsible. Put an I in front of it. And when I go to meetings, I sit in meetings, open meetings, discussion meetings, and I listen to dialogue. And if I have something to say, I raise my hand and I always try to use I. And I own whatever it is I'm talking about. And I'll say things like, I feel angry. I feel joy, fear, sadness, love. I used to come in, when I first came in, I'd say things like, well, you know, I feel confused. I'm upset. A little bit. You know, I just couldn't tell you how I really felt. Today it feels good to be able to say how I feel and what it is I want. I stand up to the plate and say, I want this. Now, I got to tell you, I don't always get it. You know, Evelyn will tell you. She's sitting right here. I ask for a lot of things that I want. And they might entail change for you. So that I can get what I want. But I still get that no. And I'm able to take that no. And learn about that. How that, what that is about me. Now, this program for me has been just a series of life-changing events. I went to college, learned how to fly an airplane, learned how to ski, snow ski, learned how to shoot a gun. Never had a gun in my life. I learned how to do marathons and run to top of summits. Every summit in California I've been to the top of. With people like you guys. People that would come over to my house at 5:30 in the morning before work and say, hey, let's go for the 5-mile run. You know? Hey, look, Sunday we're going for a 10-mile run. You know? People in this program that encourage me to keep going to the next place and discover more about who I am. And in them helping me, I was able to help someone else. And in all the things that I've gone through since I've been here in this program, I've been able to help somebody else. Whether it just be pick up a chair or drive somebody to a meeting or listen to their crisis on the telephone and just say and just repeat things back like, boy, that's interesting. Wow, sounds like you have the answer. And try to fight that urge to give my wonderful advice. You know, I wanted to tell my fiance how to raise her children. I never had kids in my life. How the hell do you do that? That's how crazy it is. I used to sit in a bar and tell people I was a medical doctor. And sit there and discuss open heart surgery. That's insane. You know, I didn't know I was doing it until I went and I shared like what happened afterwards. When I tried to tell my fiance how to do it. You're right. I says, well, I've listened to all the stories in the meetings about kids and what to do, teenagers and all that stuff. So I had to learn one more time that I don't have all the answers. And when I first got here, the old-timers said things like, the longer you're here, the less you know. Yeah. Less is more. I used to hear a guy say, what the hell does that mean? Less is more. God. You know? And the spiritual things I have today, nobody can take away. My spiritual gifts today are integrity and honesty, loyalty. And today, you know, I really am still learning. I don't have the answers today. I'm willing to learn something new. I'm willing to make a mistake today. I'm willing to let you make a mistake. And, you know, I just don't know how the hell I ever got to that place. 1 year, 1 day, 1 month. Next thing you know, here it is. Never had the desire to pick up another drink. I bought a guy a beer the day before yesterday. Went right up the bar and got it, handed it to him. He drank it and I had a Coke. No desire. I see what it does to people when they come back in here. I've been to funerals when people die. They had 2 or 3, 4, 10 years, 15 years, and they went out one time and that was it. Car accident. Went to their funerals. Stood there. Just kind of like, jeez, how'd that happen? I've seen thousands of people come through these rooms and never come back. Never seen that face again. And I wonder, why was I chosen to receive the blessing? Don't know. But I'm here tonight, and I'm thankful that you guys have me to speak. Thanks for letting me share.